bad. Now the boat won't float, I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working. We're just not working anymore.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you there by listener-supported community radio station WFT. Broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. This program of the World Labor Hour is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. This hour program is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support radio, community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor, our own WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. We're going to be having an interesting guest call in at half past the hour, Gary Huck. He was a labor cartoonist who worked for the UE, the United Electrical Workers Union, for over 30 years. He's going to call in and talk a little about his work and stuff. And Gus, you were in Atlanta all last week, weren't you?
Yeah. I was in Atlanta for the 100th anniversary of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, the African American History Organization created by Carter G. Woodson in 1915. And what it is it brings not only scholars, but everyday people to the conference to discuss not only the history, sociology, and other academic aspects of black life in America and also the world, but also just to talk about, to actually talk about the conditions and how to move forward, strategy planning, offering solutions to current crises. So it was a lot of great progressive discussion and also great networking to create organizations and strategies in Atlanta. So, you know, the 100th year anniversary, because that's how it started in 1915. It wasn't simply what a lot of these other historical organizations like OAH and AHA, American Historical Association, where a bunch of people just get together and talk about their research. That's all they do there. At this history conference, though, people actually get together from all classes of society and discuss life. And these are activists, these are professors, these are students, these are community people coming together and doing
this. That's phenomenal. Yeah. Wow.
So yeah.
Who was Carter Wood?
Carter G. Woodson was.
Woodson, okay.
Yeah. Carter G. Woodson is considered the father of black history.
Okay.
He wrote one of the first works on black history, and he created ASALA. He created the Journal of African American History, which at the time was called the Journal of Negro History.
Mm-hmm.
It's really considered the preeminent black journal for academics to publish in to this day, going back to 1915.
Wow. Okay.
So yeah, it's one of the most powerful things ever. And all those people that do black history, you know, the other scholars try to get you to publish in those mainstream journals that mm-hmm. are really not that good. But if you do black history, you need to be publishing in black journals.
Okay. Yeah, of course. Yeah. And you know, that's the thing is, you know, a lot of people, put down, you know, the whole, field of history, you know, the academic field of history, but history is so important. Wouldn't you agree, Gus? I mean, it's because if you let politicians and others define, you know, kind of revise and distort what happened in the past, they can basically fool you about why things are happening now and what should be done in the future.
Yeah, I mean, you can see it happening every day now because neoliberalization theory and process tells you to be ahistorical, because you remove the history from the actual creation of these economic programs, you see that there's a resistance mechanism that actually is successful in stopping a lot of the issues on the ground. Mm-hmm. So being ahistorical helps neoliberalization continue. And that's what a lot of the neoliberal theorists did back in the 1950s and 60s when they were getting ready to change to global capitalism. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's the biggest thing about history. History can show how systems work and how groups on the ground respond to said systems. If you do the history right, you make it interdisciplinary. You look at the sociology of groups. You look at community organizing. You use theory to apply to practical ideas mm-hmm. to show that there are actual cases that you can use, because if you use theory, you're able to make it for, to use it for future organizing and to show, okay, these things can actually work. And of course you have independent variables like technology changing and things sure. like that, but you, of course, you can use the theory to kind of, you know, lead you in the right direction with yeah. that. So that's why history and social sciences in general are important for the work that we do as organizers and as, you know, activists.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I guess we'll start with some news stories. Bob, you have an interesting one, from Wisconsin, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I'm getting most of this from, In These Times,
which is out of Chicago for the viewers who aren't familiar with In These Times. Yes.
Yeah. But it talks about Scott Walker's campaign failed because voters actually don't want a union buster in chief. It says, here Monday, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker announced that he was ending his campaign for the 2016 GOP presidential nomination. It was a week to the day after placing all his bets on his record as a union buster to propel himself into the White House. Last week in Las Vegas, Walker revealed a sweeping plan that, among other things, would rein in and potentially eliminate public worker unions at the federal level, institute a national right-to-work law compelling private sector unions to work for free, and he wanted to abolish the National Labor Relations Board established in 1936. Mm-hmm. 4 days later, his poll numbers among GOP voters tanked to a barely perceptible Half of a percent.
Yeah. That's some kind of record there.
That's pretty low. Yeah. Yeah.
So let's see, his mother, his cousins, business buddies.
Maybe his next door neighbor. Yeah. Probably the Koch.
Maybe not.
The Koch brothers, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it says, though he could Me Too his way through the base's obsession with terrorists and Mexican immigrants, his primary branding for the last 4+ years has been Union Buster in Chief. It was an old, broken record that didn't play. The most recent Gallup poll had union approval actually going up, with 58% of all respondents affirming support for organized labor. More than a third of the respondents said they wanted unions to have more influence. And the Economic Policy Institute found that 58% of workers would like to be union members instead of the meager 11% we have now as a result of decades of union busting. It says here further, the single biggest factor keeping workers' wages down, the EPI said, is the erosion of collective bargaining, which has hurt union and non-worker unions alike. It says a new and alarming study from the London School of Economics drove the point home, showing out of whack wealth distribution near depression era levels. And it says, forget the one percenters, the top 0.1% now have as much wealth as the bottom 90%.
Whoa.
So
yeah, just let's make sure that we reiterate this point, because that data is important.
It is.
Over 58% of Americans believe that unions are critical right. to life. So right. all this stuff about unions not being popular, we have to make sure that we continue to echo this wherever we go. Mm-hmm. For all those people listening that are members of unions or who are pro-labor, we have to continue this message. This shouldn't be strictly for the World Labor Hour. Take these numbers and take this information and spread it to the unions and spread it to the community, because right. we're going to have right. to use this, especially, and I'll talk about this after Bob finishes, in relation to the Supreme Court case coming up next year.
Okay. And you know what? 58% to some people may seem a little low, but this 58% is incredible if you think about the corporate media out there. I mean, they just completely ignore unions, or when they do, when they're compelled to cover them, it's always in some kind of negative spin, you know?
It says here even 42% of Republicans think unions are better, you know? You know, mm-hmm. and that we should have more influence, you know. And once again, it goes back to this rising inequality became a prime topic among presidential candidates as diverse as Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz. So that's pretty much the two opposite ends of the spectrum. It says among them, only Scott Walker wanted to do more of what's already done workers in, kill off unions. says ultimately busting unions didn't deliver the economic boom he had promised in Wisconsin. The state ranks 35th in job creation and has a $210 million deficit that the GOP legislatures are plugging money with money from budget cuts up there, which the voters hate. Walker's approval rating in the state has sank to a new low of 39% in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So it says whether voters will ever want to hear Walker's broken record again is anybody's guess. But voters, on the other hand, have clearly moved on.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing I started hearing back in the 90s, you know, about union, against unions was that, well, unions really did fulfill a good historical function, but they're really not needed anymore.
Yeah. They were important 80 years ago.
Yeah.
You know,
so, or 100 years ago.
Yeah. To prevent child labor and the, you know, 16-hour day.
We have the thing who's spreading those messages. Remember, that's really
corporate media.
Yeah. That's really the heart. You know, the process of neoliberalization goes into the early 70s and 80s, but by the 90s, that's when, you know, when NAFTA comes around and all these other things, that's the golden age of neoliberalization. That's when those messages started coming out about being ahistorical and looking at unions and labor history.
Yes, so, indeed. Yeah.
But just to kind of go back on that point, people that know me know there are very few people I hate. And I dislike, you know, I know.
Don't hold back. Come on.
No, seriously. Like, you know, they know that I'm very much so. I dislike capitalists. I hate dumb ones.
Yeah.
But
oh, I like dumb ones.
They know that too. But Scott Walker is easily one of the most despicable people ever because he had a real hatred for working people. Mm-hmm. I mean, he made his entire agenda, and he did it very sneaky from the minute he became governor to attacking the masses or the majority population of the state of Wisconsin. And he did it with a smile on his face.
It's amazing how he got elected.
It says here, he kept spinning his record for the out-of-state right-wing billionaires who funded his campaigns.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's how he got elected. I mean, he has so much money.
Yeah.
And then let's bring this up, too, that he was one of those people that went to the Koch brothers, what was the thing? It was some type of event where a lot of the Republican candidates went and were basically begging for Koch brother money.
Yeah.
And he ended up going and still getting that half percentage and not getting the funds too. You know, because like you said, people are tired of his message.
Right.
And this is key for moving forward for that Supreme Court decision now. If 58% and then you have another 42% right wing people believe that unions not as bad as the media is putting out there, then this is something that we can use to our advantage to inform and influence the Supreme Court decision that's coming out that's going to challenge the idea of right to work legislation and things like that, or what I call labor in this country, because it's going to be the most important decision over the last 100 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, I remember when Scott Walker, got elected, what his message was, if I remember correctly, was he was telling all these other working people who were not in unions that basically it's the union's fault that you don't make more money, that they're sucking up resources. And if we would just do right to work legislation, there'd be all these, corporations that would move into, Wisconsin and create more jobs. And of course that hasn't happened. It looks like just the opposite happened.
Yes.
So what's the Supreme Court decision exactly, Gus?
Well, what's happening is there was a person who was, and I can't remember the name right now, which is really bad, but there was a person who was challenging the idea of paying union dues and being part of
shop.
Yeah, thank you. Closed shop. So what's happening is that the Supreme Court is basically going to decide if this is going to be, if they're basically going to overturn a lot of labor history and the National Labor Relations Act to where people won't have to join unions anymore and collect fair share dues and things like that. So if this does pass, what's going to happen is unions are going to lose a lot of their bargaining power, half of their membership, and they're going to have to actually go and collect dues by hand instead of them being automatically taken out. And if that happens, like I said, it's going to be really difficult because of a lot of issue with profits and unions and being able to have the manpower to collect dues. I mean, it's going to be incredibly difficult for unions to continue to stay strong in this country if the Supreme Court passes this decision.
Oh yeah, this bill. That is like if they had to come to me and ask me for a check for my hourly dues. Man, that would be tough.
Yeah.
I mean, cause they're big. Our monthly dues at the laborers hall is only $25 a month. And what that does is that goes to fund like the international and per capita fees for various things like AFL-CIO and so on and so forth. But then I can't remember right now what my working dues are, but it turns out to be a lot per month.
Yeah. And the other thing too is, I mean, like, especially in public sector settings, you know, the unions are going to be forced to, I mean, now the policy is because of fair share, because the fact that, you know, people who don't want to join the union who are public employees, they still benefit from the contract. So that's exactly why the decision was that they had to at least pay half dues. And whether they're a union member or not in the public sector, a union steward will defend a worker in the public sector. What's going to have to happen is, if this happens, they're not going to be able to have the time or resources to defend non-members, you know, which is going to be, well, you know, either it's going to compel people to join the union, or it's going to give a bad attitude about unions. You know, well, it could play either way.
You can definitely see it having a very negative and regressive effect on anti-union people. Mm-hmm. They're going to see that a lot of the benefits that they had from fair share are going to be gone if they don't become members. So, but I hope it doesn't get to that point, because it's going to be a period of about 5 years where it's going to be very difficult for many unions to function the way they should. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take people to wake up that long. But, you know, that's why we have to continue to spread this word of the information that people want unions and people want organized labor.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think a lot of them are functioning as they should anyway, but another show.
A whole show. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We could start with the carpenters and the laborers.
Oh, yeah. I agree on that.
Yeah. I got an interesting story here about coming from the West Coast. I guess the nation's largest port, you know, which is in Los Angeles and Long Beach, California, is quite a varied workplace. At one extreme of the ports in California, actually the whole West Coast, there are longshore workers who belong to one of the most progressive unions in the U.S., the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, the ILWU, has brought annual incomes of over $100,000 for highly skilled workers to many of its members. At the other end, there are truck drivers for various companies that move goods from docks to warehouses who are wrongly classified as quote-unquote independent contractors, as the Regional Office of the National Labor Relations Board recently determined, who have unpredictable incomes often below minimum wage. And there are then warehouse workers who typically only earn $9 to $11 an hour, and a lot of them only work part-time for a labor contractor or for the warehouse operation itself. And once these jobs were unionized, paid reasonably, you know, decent middle-class wages, but the unions, mainly the Teamsters, lost their contracts and members over the years. So now, after 10 years, yeah?
I'm on a lot of construction jobs where there's a whole lot of owner-operator truckers, mm-hmm, and owner-operator heavy equipment.
It's moved into heavy equipment, really?
Yeah, not as common there. But, you see Teamster represented independent truck operators on the roads all the time, mm-hmm, serving construction jobs mainly. And I don't see how that model can't be applied outside of there. You know, the whole idea behind that is, well, it would be a, what they used to call an illegal combine, which is something that they applied to all unions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an antitrust issue. And, but the thing is, it works in the construction industry.
Yeah. Well, but there's a difference, you know. It's one thing working for piecework or supposedly an independent contractor if you have a complete control over your working conditions, over you know, when you start work, when you stop work, how you do the work, that kind of thing. But all this is basically these people are employees. It's just that they're classified as independent contractors, but in reality, they're employees. They work, you know, their whole work. From, you know, every aspect of their work is controlled by the people they work for, you know, which makes them an employee in definition. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I guess this has been changing after 10 years of trying to organize these low-wage workers. They're finally stepping up their game. They've been doing a lot of direct action. There's been a lot of, like, wildcat strikes, and it's actually been, you know, helping. And I guess there was a class action. There's been some legal work, too, a recent class action suit filed last December. September, workers contend that since the warehouse land belongs to the city of Los Angeles, that this company, Cartage, should have been paying, the minimum should have been paying the city's living wage.
Oh, right.
Law, living wage law. Which would imply the company would owe the workers millions of dollars. And, anyway, a lot of this has been done, organized, has been done by Teamsters and Change to Win Coalition. So anyway, they finally got some of these employers to come around, and sign contracts to get out of having to pay all these back wages and stuff. And, there's been a lot of, shutdowns. I know the IWW was organizing a lot of these port truckers back about 6 or 8 years ago. What's interesting is, how history repeats itself. A lot of these, truckers are not just, people who were born in the United States, but a lot of them are immigrants, not just from Latin America, but there's also a lot of, interesting enough, Indian Sikh, people who were, truck drivers, and they tried to play off the different groups against each other, and this is so typical. You know?
Okay, there's something that's, going on with FedEx lately.
Oh?
And I know this through personal sort of anecdotal sources.
Okay.
It appears that FedEx, which had been just calling all of its drivers independent contractors, what's happening is apparently some of these people who were formerly like just drivers are now buying multiple trucks and hiring drivers as employees.
Oh.
So that's in fact, somebody, this just came up accidentally in a conversation with a FedEx driver. He was talking about, and he attributed that to the Teamsters.
Mm.
And fortunately, I don't know this guy, and it was a conversation about something else that he happened to just interject a little bit. And I didn't get any detail on whether he was, felt that he was doing better under that or as,
Sounds like another employer scheme, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it sounds like FedEx is trying to make it look more like that they have an employee system, but still be hands off. And what they're doing is basically creating a dispatcher system, like what's happening here. And that's the same way on the construction jobs. A lot of these people are owner operators that are leased out to dispatchers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but they're still covered by a Teamsters contract, and they get a very high, because they're paying for the truck too. It's a rate for the truck as well as the driver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, that'd be interesting to know a little bit more detail on that. See what you can find out, Bill. You had some interesting.
Probably a Taft-Hartley thing.
Yeah. You have an interesting story too about, I know you talked, I think it was last week about, this new, UAW contract that was coming down the tubes.
Yeah. Another one of those people who I'm not putting in the hate category yet. he's creeping along. Dennis Williams, the president of UAW, he presented a contract to the workers at the Fiat Chrysler plant in Indiana and Michigan. So what they did was the workers there, they have actually defeated the contract being pushed by Dennis Williams in the first votes being reported from major factories. The deal was also rejected at smaller parts depots in Colorado and Los Angeles too. So you got some worker unity coming up there because they're tired of Dennis Williams pushing this austerity package on them. 57% of the production workers and 61% of the skilled trades rejected the agreement at the suburban Detroit stamping plant Thursday, according to UAW Local 1264 Facebook page. There are 2,000 workers at the Sterling stamping plant. 59% of production workers voted to reject the contract, while skilled trades workers split the vote at Kokomo Casting, a source at UAW Local 1166 reported. 65% of production workers and 52% of skilled trades voted no at Local 1248. So, what this means is, the votes are an initial expression of the deep hostility workers feel towards the sellout agreement, which the UAW is seeking to ram through with little to no time for discussion. And this is what they do. This is what these top-down unions do. And they did the same thing with the AFT when they sent those emails around and asking people to endorse Hillary Clinton. They did it at a very short time, and they did it in a very sneaky manner, so nobody got to see them before they pushed through their endorsement of Hillary Clinton as the nominee for the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. The same thing happened with Dennis Williams. He sent the contract only a day or two in advance so 2,000 workers could try to discuss it before they vote. That didn't work. Yeah. So the workers said, we're not voting on this until we all have read it. And they did it, and they see that it's an austerity measure. Now, the next thing they need to vote on is to oust Dennis Williams as the UAW president. Get him out of here.
I'm telling you from my own experience, it's in various community union. It is difficult to get rid of these, not just international presidents, but even regional, presidents. Yeah. You know, unfortunately, Canada has much better labor laws than the United States. Canadian labor laws actually is based on the will of the membership. United States, it's more of a franchisee, type of, interpretation, you know, so that basically the law, basically always, is more often than not in favor of the internationals or the regional, unions.
Let's but I also want to point out, you're talking about two things that are, that were being done, you know, not in a very good way, right? And in order to get something achieved, and it's sort of underhandedly, but these are two things. Nobody surveys anybody in the laborers about what politicians to support. We don't get to vote on contracts at all. You know, I mean, and as
which
far
is absurd.
And here's another one.
Yeah.
Back when they had the big uproar in the laborers in the 90s, you know, and Arthur Coya got punished by being president emeritus, where he doesn't even have to retire. He just gets paid his full salary and everything.
So you can buy another Ferrari.
Right, yeah. But anyway, one of the things that they did was they made direct vote for president of the laborers union. Who cares?
Yeah.
You know, who runs?
Yes, indeed. Okay, we're going to take this call here. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Hey, hi, this is Gary Huck calling.
Hello, Gary. Welcome to the World Labor Hour. Could you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Sure. My name's Gary Huck. That's spelled like Huckleberry Finn. And I'm currently living in Baltimore after moving from Chicago earlier this summer. I'm a political cartoonist, recently retired from the UE, which stands for United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers of America, blessedly abbreviated as UE. I held that position for 29 years. And as of now, I was the last full-time political cartoonist employed by a labor union in North America.
Okay, yeah, you know, we found out about you, basically one of my co-hosts brought in, a Chicago Tribune article about you, and I was really, you know, as amazing, a lot of things were amazing about that article. One is I had no idea, that there was still, a union around, that actually employed a full-time cartoonist. Of course, knowing about labor history, it wasn't that uncommon, you know, back in the 30s or, you know, maybe even before. And the other thing was just, when I looked, kind of did some research and saw some of your work, it's like, oh yeah, I've seen that before. Oh yeah. I mean, your stuff has really gotten around and everything. And, you know, also I have to say that the UE, the United Electrical Workers, is one of my favorite unions out there. It's a very, rank and file Democrat union in which the top national president's salary has to be no more than the highest paid rank and file. So I mean, coming from a very corrupt authoritarian union like the Carpenters, this of course appealed to me and also a lot of my other Carpenter colleagues who were in the Carpenters Rebellion in the late 90s. We really admired the UE, and when we were hoping to get a new Carpenters Union formed, we were going to model it after the UE. But nonetheless, so that was why you really sparked my interest. And so maybe you could just talk a little about your career, like maybe how you first started working as a cartoonist for the UE.
Well, this is what happened. I grew up in Racine, Wisconsin, which is just about an hour and 15 minutes north of Chicago on Lake Michigan. And at one time, Racine, Wisconsin had more union members per capita than anywhere else in the country. And there's an industrial belt that goes up to Manitowoc where, and I should mention, I am currently run a syndication of progressive and labor cartoons with Mike Konopacki, who their offices are in Madison, Wisconsin, and Mike and I have been running the syndication since 1983. And Mike grew up in Manitowoc. So we grew up in near cities, which were industrial cities on Lake Michigan. Each city had great public schools, open parks, free golf courses, all of which were paid for by property taxes of union-paid workers. And all of that has been decimated since the beginning of the Reagan administration. When I was growing up, I moved away. I went to California, went to college. I was in the Marines for a couple of years. When I came back to Racine and was attending the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee for graduate school, I had the opportunity. I was also working in commercial art, which I hated. Designing t-shirt transfers. And I had the opportunity to contribute cartoons to the teacher strike in Racine. Now, keep in mind, the teacher strike at that time was the longest teacher strike in the history of the country.
What year was that?
It has to be in the late 70s.
Late 70s, okay.
It was. It was in the mid to late 70s. And there's Racine, because of all the union members, had this wonderful labor paper called Racine Labor. And Racine Labor was funded by a coalition of unions, and it consisted of they also took ads. But they had a series of these amazing editors, and two of which I worked directly for, which were Dick Olson, who went on to work for the UAW, and Roger Bybee, who's still a freelance journalist in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Both brilliant writers and very good investigative reporters. So Racine had a voice for labor, a very sophisticated voice for labor. And so I started doing cartoons directly for the teachers' union, but was very quickly asked to start contributing cartoons to Racine Labor. And because of those cartoons, meanwhile, Mike Konopacki is participating in a newspaper strike in Madison. So he is being asked to contribute cartoons. At that time, he was freelancing, doing a lot of work for Progressive Magazine. Mike started contributing cartoons to the strike paper. The strike paper hired him as a full-time cartoonist, and then because of his work, me and Racine Labor, Mike and Madison started, our work started being picked up by labor unions. So in 1983, Mike and I are driving to attend a cartoonist convention in Toronto. And on the way there, we come up with this idea of forming a syndication. Because up to that point now, we are competing with one another in the labor press. So being good lefties, we decided to join forces rather than compete against one another. So mm-hmm. We started Huck Konopacki Labor Cartoons in 1983. Meanwhile, the only full-time political cartoonist employed by a labor union in the United States is employed by UE. His name is Fred Wright. I encourage everyone to Google Fred Wright. The University of Pittsburgh has his entire collection. They've posted thousands of cartoons online. He was a brilliant, brilliant cartoonist. At some point, I will write about that because the true definition of where he fits in the lexicon of political cartooning has not yet been recognized as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, so Fred gets very sick, and it's really too bad. He's in his 70s, he has cancer, and he no longer can come to work. But you have an organization, the UE, that has had the privilege and relied on having in-house a political artist to illustrate and cartoon for their publications, their organizing drive. The cartoonist is part of the life of the union. You cannot separate the union from the work of the cartoonist at that point. He'd been doing this now for four decades. So they don't even sit around and go, oh, well, now we don't have to pay a cartoonist. They have to find a way to replace Fred's work. So they start running Hakanapeki cartoons while Fred struggles with this awful disease. Fred succumbs to the disease. Unfortunately, he dies. Mike and I attend his memorial service in New York. We meet the UE officers, and then the UE convention the following year, which is 85, I believe, is being held in Milwaukee, and they invite us to attend. Mike is somewhere else at the time and can't attend. I go to the convention. New officers are being elected at this convention, and I meet the Secretary Treasurer, and she says, how would you like to come to work for the UE? So in 86, I moved to New York City, and after some years there, the entire union moved its national headquarters to Pittsburgh.
Okay. You of course, lived in Chicago for a while. I've been in the UE local office there on corner Ashland and I think Monroe or Madison Monroe, I think. And it's a really, when you walk in, there's this huge mural that goes all the way up the stairs. And I mean, you really get a sense. And I was sitting here listening to sort of your story and the importance that UE had on cartoonists was that it seems like, you know, the visual element in art is very important for communicating, you know, concepts and ideas and stuff, because the mural is really fascinating. It goes up the stairs. You've seen it, of course, you know.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. And it's great because it's kind of like the history of the UE. And my favorite part of the mural is where it shows, it looks like it's a scene from the 1930s where they're negotiating with this guy with a cigar in his mouth and a desk, and behind him is a curtain that says PIMPCO, and it's like pimp company, and he's trying to say, looks like he's saying how broke he is, but behind the curtain there's a safe with tons of like money and gold in it and everything, and and you show the union people look like they have a real confident smiles on their face, and the guy that's the boss is just like, looks like he's about ready to lose it.
That's actually based on Fred Wright.
That's based on Fred Wright? Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a reference to Fred's work.
And okay.
He invented this company, PIMPCO, that shows up in a lot of his cartoons.
Okay. So great name, PIMPCO, yeah.
Yeah. And there's a mural in Erie, Pennsylvania that was done by Juana Alicia from San Francisco that recognizes the international work of the union. So, no, that's right. So once, Mike and I do a slide presentation, called The History of Labor Cartooning, and we've done it all over the country recently at CMU, Carnegie Mellon, and we basically show that through the WOPs and into the masses and then the new masses, there was a relationship between radical artist and radical labor.
Mm-hmm.
So once McCarthyism hit, that all cooled off. And as a footnote to the history we're talking about, Fred Wright actually was working after World War II, where he was a cartoonist with the Army paper. I can't think of the name right now, but he
Stars and Stripes, by chance?
Yes, Stars and Stripes.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came back to New York, and he was a saxophone player, and traveled on cruise ships that went to Cuba and back, and he was very much radicalized by his experience of these cruise ships and the idle rich going off to gamble and exploit the Cubans, and so he started contributing cartoons to the Maritime Workers Union, which he was a member of. And then when they started asking him to draw right-wing cartoons, because if you know about the history of the maritime unions, on the left coast, they were very radical. On the right coast, they were very conservative. And he refused to do that. And when the UE became aware of the stand he was taking, they asked him to join staff.
Yeah.
So that era wiped out a lot of the relationship between the left in America and labor movement.
Yeah,
to the detriment of both, the detriment of both organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So the left, as a that relied on the labor movement, the same way the Democratic Party now relies on the labor movement as an unpaid force that keeps them in office, even though they continue to betray the labor movement.
Mm-hmm.
The left did rely on the labor movement. It was the symbiote, you know what I'm trying to ask.
Yes.
Relationship, and it was destroyed by right wing forces, and both institutions suffered.
Yes.
And the labor movement never recovered, and the UE just kept that tradition going. They saw no reason to stop. Their membership can continue to dwell. And I want to say that if you're a worker in America and you need a labor union, or you're in a corrupt union and you want to be liberated, please contact the UE. The UE it needs new members. The American labor movement needs the UE to survive. So I encourage people to run in droves, hundreds of thousands and millions of people to that union, because you will be respected and your dues will not be spent in vain, and you will be part of the leadership of the union if you want to work for it.
Yes, I'll second
and
that.
Educate yourself and struggle
mm-hmm.
For something other than what you have, which is getting close to nothing. So I'm a little grumpy at my fellow citizens for their, their inability somehow to organize. They'd rather separate on the basis of race and religion and sex and women's rights to choose. And you're wasting your precious time. You're wasting your precious life. Get over that crap and organize.
That's a great message.
Brought to you by Gary Huckam, Huckam Becky Labor Church.
So you live in Baltimore now?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The woman I married to, who is Tavia La Follette, who is the great, great granddaughter of Fighting Bob La Follette.
Oh, wow.
Who is, and so my two sons, my 5-year-old twin sons, are the legacy of the La Follettes. And hopefully when they are old enough, they're only 5 now, they will go back to Wisconsin and reclaim its heritage for the progressive message.
Yes.
Or maybe they won't.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like, you know, Baltimore, there's a lot going on there right now. I mean,
yes,
wow.
Yes, that's right. It's a good place to be. Black Lives Matter is a force within the city. There's a lot of a very helpful conversation going on. Tavia is a theater professor at Towson University. And we moved to Chicago because of her position at DePaul in the theater department. And she does very progressive theater. She works on the international stage, bringing together artists from, we did an exchange between our artists in Egypt and the U.S., and we tried to do one between artists from Israel and Palestine in the U.S., but that ran into a wee bit of trouble.
I bet.
And,
yes.
And now she's working on an exchange between U.S. and South African artists.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So,
yes.
Yeah, she does very, very good work.
And are you still doing this labor slideshow you were talking about earlier? Do you still tour
sure.
with that occasionally?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We anytime we're asked to, we will come and present it, either Mike or myself or both of us. And it's a very lively presentation. We include, I mean, there are people who are contributing art to the labor movement, and these names should be on people's Google list. Mike Alowitz, the muralist, who is a university professor in Connecticut, but he does powerful, powerful work. There's a book of his work that he collaborated with Paul Buell to produce. There's Bill Young, who lives Pittsburgh, and he's a retired steam fitter, or what is he? A pipe fitter.
Okay.
And he's a very talented artist. He's done a few comic books about the history of working class struggles around Pennsylvania. There's Carol Simpson, of course, from Chicago, that do labor cartoons. They have a very large backlog of cartoons on very, very talented. Probably the only writer-artist combination that I know of doing political art. Most cartoonists work alone.
Mm-hmm.
But so, and there's other people too. Okay. Out there. And I encourage, if you, you know, for your local, to find find artists that work in your local who were, who maybe be amateur at this point, but give them a chance. Give them a voice. Give them a platform. We also do, Mike and I do this thing, this collaged workshop, which is an amazing way to express your, if you want to get a sense of what political cartoonists do, we offer this opportunity of people to use the collage method, meaning cutting up magazines, and we've done this now hundreds of times, and the anxiety about not being able to draw, or the anxiety that your drawing isn't very good, all goes away because now you're using the collage method, and it's a lot of fun, and the workshop has never failed. We've done it for hundreds of people at a time, and everyone has a good time, and they produce amazing work.
Yeah, another form of cutting and pasting, I guess you could call it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Gary, listen, we've ran out of time, but thank you so much for calling in, and I definitely, I want to follow up with you privately about maybe some of these, you know, the tours, the slideshow, and these other things you mentioned, because I think that's such an important part, you know, that the labor movement needs to bring back, because it can be a very, very powerful and effective tool.
And it's our heritage.
Yeah, it's our heritage,
and,
yes.
Mm-hmm. People should know about it and embrace it, and thank you for this opportunity to pontificate for 20 minutes.
Nope, no problem. It's been our pleasure, and we'll talk soon.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. Goodbye.
The workers on the SP line strike sent out to call, but Casey Jones, the engineer, he wouldn't strike at all. His boiler, it was leaking, and his drivers on the bus, and his engine and its bearings, they were all out of plumb.
Casey Jones
kept his junk pile running.
Casey Jones
was working double time.
Casey Jones
got a wooden medal for being good and faithful on the SP line.
Casey Jones kept the junk pile running. Casey Jones was working double time. Casey Jones got the wooden medal for being good and faithful on the SP line.
The worker said to Casey, won't you help us win this strike? But Casey said, let me alone, you'd better take a hike. Then someone put a bunch of railroad ties across the track, and Casey hit the river with an awful smack.
Casey Jones
hit the river bottom.
Casey Jones
broke his bloomin' spine.
Casey Jones
was an Angelino. He took a trip to heaven on the SP line.
Casey Jones hit the river bottom. Casey Jones broke his bloomin' spine. Casey Jones was an Angelino. He took a trip to heaven on the SP line.
When Casey Jones got up to heaven to the pearly gate, he said, I'm Casey Jones, the guy that pulled the SP freight. You're just the man, said Peter, our musicians went on strike. You can get a job of scabbing any time you like.
Casey Jones
got a job in heaven.
Casey Jones
was doing mighty fine.
Casey Jones
was scabbing on the angels just like he did to workers on the SP line.
Casey Jones got a job in heaven. Casey Jones was doing mighty fine. Casey Jones was grabbing on the angels out like you get to work it on the empty line.
The angels got together and they said it wasn't fair.
Okay, we're back. That was the song Casey Jones from the anthology of the 1930s Leftist Roots of the Folk Revival. And okay, that was Casey Jones, Union Scab, a different version of Casey Jones. But anyway, some quick public service announcements here. I guess the 15th anniversary of the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center is coming up here soon from Thursday, October 9th until Sunday, October 11th. And it's going to be from starting at 5:30 that Thursday, October 9th, and we'll give you some more details as we get closer. But it's open to the public. Events are free, and you know, this started out here was interesting. Is the Independent Media Center here in town started up? It officially opened up in early 2001, and it was motivated by a lot of people. It was about maybe a couple dozen people here in, from Champaign-Urbana that went out to the big WTO protest in Seattle back in you know, in 1999, and
Peter Miller about drove me crazy talking about it. He thought it was so cool.
One of the original hosts of the program, and just to let people know that history. This was what formed the Independent Media Center. Our local Central Labor Council actually helped finance four people from the School for Design and Society for their expenses to go out there and protest in Seattle, and I was partly responsible for that because I was vice president and political director at that time, and got a lot of grief from it from some of the building trades also the local News Gazette newspaper.
What are those weirdo hippie people or something?
Yeah. But anyway, they came back and started the Independent Media Center, so there's going to be a lot of people that have been around all these years, as well as some people coming in from into town that has since moved away that were part of the forming the Independent Media Center. So again, that'll be starting Thursday, October 9th. We'll have some more details as we get closer to the event. And also just let you know, this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. is Labor's Worldview TV on Comcast Channel 6 and live at UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. And this week will be part two of 9/11 Press for the Truth about the women called the Jersey Girls, who were the wives of some of the victims of the 9/11 attack, who didn't buy the official story that the government, the Bush administration, the corporate media was trying to peddle. And it basically is a great documentary. It's been shown on Link TV and other things. It's won some awards and played at the Art Theater back when it first came out here in town, and it's a really, really good film. I mean, it's this is not conspiracy theory, this is conspiracy fact. So tune in.
Yeah, another round of airshifter training is starting up here at WEFT. So if you recently pledged during our pledge drive at the $40 level or above, you're a WEFT member, and that entitles you to take free airshifter training. And that happens in four sessions. First date is Thursday, October 15th at 6 p.m. And second session is Wednesday, October 21st. And then you take two sessions here in the front studio. So if you're interested and you became a WEFT member recently during our pledge drive, send an email to airshiftertraining@weft.org, or you can give Vicki a call at 217-778-1664. And or you can stop by here. We've got the forms to fill out in the front foyer area, and you can just slide it into the envelope on the bulletin board. So once again, if you pledged, if you didn't pledge, you can still pledge now online at weft.org, and this would be your first step to maybe getting your own show here at WEFT.
Yes, indeed. Okay, and Gus, you got some other interesting news for us, too, in the last you know, 5-10 minutes here.
Yeah, definitely. So a lot of people have been paying attention and understanding that this guy Donald Trump is
the Donald.
Yeah, the Donald. Yeah, this guy Donald Trump. A lot of people just know Trump as being a businessman and being somebody who's always talking bad about immigrants. But people don't really know, and Bill really helped me out a lot with this, in that there are people in the working class who talk about Trump and don't really know about who he actually is and who he's talking to, because they may think that he's talking to help, but there are things about his policies and his plan that aren't being told to the people. So, and the reason I'm doing this is because recently he has dipped in the polls because of his embarrassing show in the last election. He's not completely out of the race.
The last
yet.
Election, you mean the last debate?
The last debate.
Yeah. Okay. You know, too, he's also been prevaricating a lot.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of things the last few weeks were, because his big thing was always, oh, outspoken, says what he means, blah, blah, blah. And he's been walking things back just like every other politician.
Yep.
You know, but people haven't really been attributing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry. So yeah, but exactly. And I think that's incredibly important to knowing who Donald Trump is. So I'm going to do a little contextualization of who Trump is and what he's doing. So basically, for those that don't know, Donald Trump is what I would consider an arrogant real estate billionaire who puts his name in big letters on buildings, as if someone might forget that it's his, and trades insults as easily as he transforms working class and African American predominantly housing into playgrounds for the rich. He did this in Atlanta over the past 10 years.
Okay, so he's throwing low-income people out of houses to build these giant towers. Some places.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what he's doing. And that's what he built his reputation on, is removing working class and poor people out of areas and building Trump Towers and business real estate type areas, you know. So his campaign for the Republican presidential nomination hasn't left the headlines since it began, and his first place ranking, which is no longer first place anymore, among all other candidates, has many political analysts scratching their heads. What is this? With his arrogant in-your-face style, Trump claims he wants to put ordinary people first, but his message is toxic brew of populist rhetoric about fighting for the, quote, little guy, mixed with nationalistic attacks on China, immigrant bashing, black people bashing, and insults directed at Muslims, women, and working people. If you go to Donald Trump's Make America Great Again website to find out what he stands for, there are just two entries in his so-called position section.
two positions.
4 months into his campaign, he's only got two entries in his position section. The first position is about protecting the Second Amendment. It declares that empowering law-abiding gun owners to defend themselves is an important way to fight crime. Wow. Even though those that know the Constitution and actually have read it, it's very short if you haven't read it, and it, obviously Donald Trump hasn't, they know that the Second Amendment is directed towards state militias and not the everyday people, so Republicans and right-wing conservatives can stop throwing that crap out there about gun ownership rights. Read the Constitution. Number two, the second position concerns immigration reform, including plans for building a 2,000-mile wall between Mexico and the U.S. and making Mexico pay for it. It calls for greater law enforcement powers for police to apprehend, quote, criminals who cross our border, end quote, and an end to birthright citizenship, under which the children of immigrants born in the U.S. are citizens.
Now, I thought there was a wall already between the U.S. and Mexico.
Oh, no. He wants this
a bigger wall.
He wants this legion of doom wall.
But it's going to happen. No, wait a minute. Here's the exact stuff that he exactly said the other day. I watched this. It's going to be a wall. It's going to have a big, beautiful door. Yeah. You okay. To come through a big, beautiful door. I mean, just the way he puts things is hilarious. It's not just going to be a door. It's going to be a big, beautiful door.
With a Trump sign, probably. And
it's marble. And that's for the leak to come in legally.
Yeah, okay.
To the big, beautiful doors.
Yeah.
So to contextualize why these just ridiculous notions and the way Trump presents himself are so important now, the reason he gets a mass hearing in his campaign is speaking to a section of the U.S. population that is frustrated with the economic crisis and how little mainstream politics has to offer them. Trump puts across a twisted version of an argument against Washington's status quo, including the Republican Party role in it. His success before recently underscores the real difficulties of the GOP establishment in motivating their voting base, because everybody knows that they are so far removed from the people and what they want and human rights violations that are going on, that Trump is basically trying to play at both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Only in the warped world of American politics could a real estate billionaire who owes a significant part of his fortune to preying on working class people pretend to be representing working people against the establishment. And that's what a lot of his message has been. He's going, if you watch the debates, he goes at the Republicans claiming that they're corrupt, they get paid off, they do this and that. Yeah.
And, Bill O'Reilly's always done this. He's there for the little guy.
Yeah.
Standing up for the little guy.
Yeah.
And that's what he's been doing. He's been trying to manipulate this message of I care about little people. And those Republicans that are on the stage with me, I'm not with them. That has nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
But in fact, like I said, I'm a big believer in historical creatures. You are what you repeatedly do. And he has made money off of praying and basically destroying the lives of the masses of people in this country. Some of the media understand who Trump is aiming to reach with his right-wing populism, because that's what it is. It's right-wing populism. But they accept at face value the idea that he is speaking for the interests of a section, white conservative, of the working class. Now, this is where it gets interesting, and we start going into history now, because one of the biggest things about the working class struggles that we talk about is that you're fracturing of working class groups during the antebellum period that kind of destroyed the idea of a worker revolution during Reconstruction, when black and white workers actually got together in industrial capitalism and also on plantation farms in the South, and there could have been a revolution. But there was this psychological wage that was brought forth that made white working class people have a different ideology than black workers because of, again, that skin color idea. And what Trump is doing is he's focusing and talking to the actual masses. The majority population in this country are white working class people.
Well, I was just going to say we had a similar situation in the early 1970s. And what I've been saying quite often lately is we needed a revolution, but we got OSHA, the EPA, affirmative action, and so on. We got a big series of reforms that, by the way, kind of set the working class against environmentalists.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Brought down, kind of set the white working class against white male working class against everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of creepy the way that worked out.
Yeah. And to conclude on this, this is going to act, what does this mean moving forward for not only the Republican Party, but the Democratic Party, and how us from the working class, and anybody really looks at these politicians and understands that this system is broken. Both parties face a similar problem. How to get voters tired of the status quo to support candidates like Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton, both from wealthy and well-connected political dynasties, and the very definition of the Washington establishment, however much they protect it. The campaign of Bernie Sanders, a self-described socialist, and I put that in quotation marks because I argue he's not a socialist, who is taking up issues of economic and social justice, is getting an enthusiastic response on the Democratic side. And what Bernie Sanders is doing, he's exploiting this idea that he's different from the Democratic message, and he's using that, and people are getting excited. Even if he's lying, it's the fact that he's saying different things than the Democratic Party is used to, and they're using that controversial message to build his popularity. Mm-hmm. That's why Bernie Sanders is so popular right now. It's because his message is different than the status quo Democratic Republican line of presenting garbage platforms to people.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a problem. But where Sanders offers a whiff of hope in the riding presidential nomination, Trump is what I consider to be the stink of despair. And his rotting smell permeates not only through the Republican Party, but the Democratic Party. So the reason I wanted to do this story is that even though he's falling now, he won't win the nomination at this point. We have to be careful for the Democratic and Republican Party, those of you that are really big into this, is that whiff that Trump is laying out is what a lot of these candidates are laying out too. The only difference between him and them is that he actually was more vocal about certain things, but they all have the same histories. These candidates have made a lot of money off the working class people and preying on them in doing so. So my major message to end this is don't judge them on what they say. Judge them on their historical record and what they have done. Regardless of whatever party they're in, even if they're not in the two main parties, judge them on their history, because we are historical creatures. We will continue to do what we always have done.
Well, Trump's clothing lines, his ties and his shirts were always made in China. China, Mexico, they're always beating us. Beating us with Chinese products.
And not to mention the television show he had on. What was it called? The Apprentice or whatever? I mean, that whole show, I mean, you talk about trying to set you think about it, we're under, you know, there's all different realms out there, you know, the political, the economic, there's also the cultural. And what that show did was it basically got these people to stab each other in the back and fight each other to try to get hired as his assistant, you know, and get paid, real big money. Mm-hmm. So basically it reinforced this whole idea of doing that in the workplace to your fellow workers, you know, and basically glorified.
Oh, you mean the Amazon model?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's call it what it is.
Yeah.
Individualism.
Yes.
You know, this
and I don't mean warrior women. I mean Amazon, the company.
The company,
which is incredibly contradictory if you look at what nationalism is supposed to stand for. This idea of individualist nationalism. It's a contradictory idea. So what Trump is pushing and what he's always been about in his history, and Clinton as well, is just this contradictory message, because we know who they are and what they've been doing and exploiting people. So stop with the ridiculous messages.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Well, that was great, Gus. I think that was really, really important. You had one other thing you wanted to mention too.
We got to make sure we show support for the University of Missouri graduate workers right now. Mm-hmm. They are fighting for fair pay. Just to give you all a quote of what they actually make, the minimum compensation for a graduate worker or a graduate employee, which is usually a teaching assistant or a research assistant that's getting a degree at the University of Missouri, is $12,100 a year.
What?
Yeah. That's a half-time contract. In contrast, a living wage for a single person in that area, according to the MIT Living Wage Calculator, after tax income is $18,102. So many graduate workers at the University of Missouri on quarter-time appointments are living well below the state and federal poverty line.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to make sure that when we talk about organizing and we're spreading words across social media and in newspapers and other forms of media, that we show support to the graduate students at the University of Missouri who are fighting very hard against their administration.
Great. Okay, well, thanks for tuning in, everybody. You've been listening to the World Labor Hour. Stay tuned for the Union Edge. And until next week, be safe and power the people. Man, Bob, you had something else real quick?
We're going to do labor history in two first, and then the Union Edge.
I wanted to mention, the last week was a premiere of the labor history in 2 minutes, which is produced by the Illinois History Society. We're going to do that on a regular basis here. So, yes, right after this, you'll hear labor history in two, followed by the Union Edge. So anyway, until next week, be safe and power the people. Take care.